Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It's been a dry year in South Texas, too. I haven't heard many reports from the valley, but ordinarily they start planting as early as late February if it's warm enough and if they've got moisture on their dry land. So we'll have to see how that goes. I've heard Corpus is beginning to plant, but it's dry there from Corpus up to Victoria area. So they need a few more planting rains.
Texas AgriLife cotton economist, Dr. John Robinson.
They do have the advantage of being the earliest new crop in the country, and generally they plant high quality varieties. So, but you're right, they need the right weather at harvest time, which they've had some trouble with that in recent years, although last year was an excellent year for them.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We are estimating 89.5 million acres to be planted to corn this season. Now, that is down 4.1% or 3.87 million acres from what was planted to corn last year. You can see we're expecting decreases in the top four states, Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and Minnesota. In fact, if we look at this over time, again, you can see the sharp decline from what we saw planted last year. In fact, this is the largest decline since back in 2014 when we dropped 4.77 million acres from the previous season.
And Lance Honig is the chief of USDA's crop branch with the National Ag Statistics Service on the planting intentions.
Based on, again, the survey work that we did, we're expecting 91 million acres of soybeans to be planted this year. That's up 4.3% or 3.76 million acres from what was planted last year. And so you can just see where the acres mostly went that we took out of corn. We just shifted them over to soybeans here. A lot of switching happening there, of course, based on some of the high nitrogen prices, pushing to more farmers toward soybeans than corn. I would point out that this would represent the third time in history that we have planted more soybeans than corn in the U.S. should these intentions be realized. And again, just to put a little perspective around it here, you can see I didn't mention on the previous slide, but the 91 million acres does represent a new record high soybean planted acreage here in the U.S.
That's corn and soybeans. And what about cotton?
Cotton acres expected to total 12.2 million acres this season. That's up 9% or just over a million acres from what was planted last season. If we take a look at that over time, you can see, again, with the prices currently remaining strong for cotton, some pretty big increases expected there. Looking at it on a state-by-state basis, you can see we're expecting planted area to be up from last year in all states except Arizona. Of course, they're a relatively small acreage state. Texas, of course, our largest producing state, you can see expectations there are up 455,000 acres from what they actually planted last season.
There's also a lot of interest right now in winter wheat acres.
This is our second estimate of the season for winter wheat seedings for this current crop season. You can see we're now estimating 34.2 million acres planted this year. That's down just 0.5% or 161,000 acres from what we estimated back in January. However, it is still up 1.7% or 588,000 acres from what was planted last season. We're looking at about 23.7 million acres of hard red winter wheat, about 6.9 million acres of soft red, and about 3.6 million acres of white wheat this season. Again, looking at the winter wheat acreage over time, you can see we're actually looking at the second consecutive year of increasing acres after seven consecutive seasons of decline.
There are some concerns about domestic hay production.
Producers expecting to harvest just 50.3 million acres of all hay this season. That's down 0.8% from what they actually harvested last year. I've realized that would be the lowest hay harvested area since 1907.
And finally, Honig points towards sorghum acres and says USDA expects fewer.
Big drop in sorghum. You can see it's 6.2 million acres, down 15.1%. Of course, last year we saw a huge increase in sorghum acres, and that's coming back off this season in favor of other crops.
Chief of USDA's crop branch with the National Ag Statistics Service, Lance Honig. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Russia's population is about 3.5 times that of Ukraine. If you looked at their 2021 GDP, Ukraine's GDP looks very low relative to that of Russia. That's because the ruble was weak last year. And if Ukraine's GDP were calculated based on purchasing power parity, it would be substantially higher.
At a recent Farm Foundation forum, Dr. William Leifert, private consultant and retired from the Economic Research Service.
Both economies rebounded fairly well in 2021 after the COVID-induced fall in GDP in 2020, with growth at 3.5% for Ukraine and 4.7% for Russia.
He also took a look at agricultural contributions.
Both Ukraine and Russia are big grain producers. Ukraine is one of the top corn producers in the world, with output averaging 36 million tons over the last 3 years. It is also a sizable producer of wheat and barley, and the largest producer of sunflower seed. Sunflower seed, of course, is not a grain, but I'm including it in the discussion because Ukraine and Russia are the world's two biggest producers. Russia is the world's third largest wheat producer, averaging 78 million tons a year over the last 3 years. Russia is also a sizable producer of corn, largest world producer of barley, and second biggest producer of sunflower seed. Russia is also a major producer and exporter of fertilizer, but I'm going to exclude that product from most of my discussion. If you look at exports, Ukraine's main agricultural export is corn, with average exports over the last 3 years of 27 million tons. Ukraine is also a substantial export of wheat and largest export of sunflower seed oil. Russia is the world's largest export of wheat, with exports averaging 35 million tons over the last 3 years. To really summarize, Russia, largest world wheat exporter, Ukraine, big corn exporter, and non-trivial wheat exporter.
So when you combine Ukraine and Russia, you end up with really two major players.
But what the world is really interested in is these countries' shares in the world grain trade. Over the last 3 years, Russia and Ukraine have combined for 28% of world wheat exports, with Russia being dominant. They account for 18% of corn exports, that's mainly Ukraine, 31% of barley exports, and 77% of sunflower seed oil, with Ukraine itself supplying 50% of world sunflower seed oil exports.
But in order to have a greater appreciation for the cities we're hearing about and the maps we're seeing, he says,
let's begin in the south with the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia seized from Ukraine in 2014. To the northeast of Crimea is the Sea of Azov. To the south and west is the Black Sea. Ukraine's capital, largest city, is Kyiv, up in the north central. Other Ukrainian cities, much in the news these days, if you move due east from Kyiv, close to the Russian border, is Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second largest city, currently under Russian attack. Drop down south, a little southeast, to the Sivazov in the city of Mariupol. This city is also being besieged. In fact, for 2 days in a row, the main headline of the Washington Post here in D.C. has involved the Russian siege of Mariupol. Jump to the west, along the coast there to the southwest, and you get the city of Odessa, which is Ukraine's main port.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We have been looking at potential fraud in all the programs because we know that there is always a potential whenever there's a large amount of money. We also, as you know, have a hotline, and so we receive any number of allegations pertain to all of USDA programs.
Testifying before a House Appropriations Subcommittee on Agriculture, USDA Inspector General Phyllis Fong.
We've been working very closely with the Farm Service Administration on the CFAP program in a proactive way to try and identify potential indicators of fraud. And we did that with FSA very early on. We issued a number of bulletins to their staff to say, take a look at this. If you've got situations coming up where you might see this indicator, please contact us because it's really important to get involved at the front end on these kinds of issues. We've also received allegations in the food box program We've had a number of cases that have looked at those allegations. And as well, you know, in the SNAP program, the feeding programs, we receive allegations and run those down as well.
Answering a question of whether broadband funding goes where the needs really are.
We actually have been following the broadband programs over a number of years. It's a matter that we regularly audit on a periodic basis. We do have an ongoing audit right now of the ReConnect program, which looks precisely at the issues you're talking about, eligibility of recipients, making sure that recipients are appropriately selected. And through that audit, we hope to also evaluate whether RUS has addressed concerns that we've raised in prior audits over the years. And of course, as you mentioned, under the Infrastructure Act, we do have oversight responsibility of those funds. And we are at this time evaluating how best to move forward with that.
She also had an interaction with Representative Andy Harris from Maryland on something known as data stories.
One of the fascinating parts of this job is that I learn a lot of new things. And in reading your testimony, I came across the term data story. I'm sorry, I'm just not familiar with what a data story is. So I did what everyone else would do and Google it. And I'm curious if what I understand is true, is why would the OIG's office be doing data stories about programs? Why wouldn't, for instance, the Farm Service Agency do the data story about CFAP payments? I mean, why would it fall to the OIG's office?
And that's a really interesting question. We view it as part of our role to bring transparency to government spending and how funds are being used. And we also view it as an opportunity for us when we do these data stories to generate our own thinking about potential audit, inspection, and investigative work. So we do it for those, you know, a range of reasons. In terms of explaining it, I'd be happy to ask Jenny Roan to offer some comments if you would like more detail on that. We have a data story coming out soon, which I think is very exciting.
Yeah, Ms. Fong, maybe just send me a copy of the data story. Thank you very much. I yield back.
But the chairwoman of the House Appropriations Committee, Rosa DeLauro, still upset they haven't investigated JBS.
They have been found guilty. We know what happens when someone is found guilty, and that we cannot seem to have an investigation to deal with suspension and disbarment seems to be an abdication of responsibility and the abdication of the independent authority that you have to move forward on this. There would appear to be no going back and looking at what is there. You got a fait accompli. They are guilty of violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. There is so much documentation, and yet we just seem to be, we cannot move. I need to know why, and I want to know how soon we will have an investigation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Today, prospective planting and the stocks report came out, quarterly stocks report. And so on the corn, we were down 4% at 89.5. And soybeans, we were up 4% at 91. All wheat came in a percentage higher at 47.4. And on cotton, we were up 9% at 12.1.
Donna Hughes is a broker with StoneX, recapping USDA's prospective plantings report out on Thursday.
Expected 12 on cotton, but that's you know, that may twist the numbers a little bit from what we've seen. We've had quite a run up in cotton over the last few months, and so we'll see how it goes with that.
Earlier in the day in Washington, D.C., Lance Honig, chief of USDA's crop branch at the National Ag Statistics Service.
I always like to remind everyone that March is intentions. It is estimates of planted acreage based on farmers' reported intentions. Essentially, that's what we like to remind folks with this graphic. As you can see on the left, that gold-colored bar, that's the survey period. If you look at the gray and the black lines, you can see that's the average planting progress for corn and soybeans in the U.S., so obviously we're collecting this intention information before farmers in most cases are in the fields planting. And so there are some changes that can occur as we move through the rest of the season. Before we talk individual crops, let me give you a big picture look at what's happening this season. We'll start things off by looking at the principal crop planted acreage. Of course, the principal crops is simply a sum of the 22 major crops grown across the U.S. The blue box at the bottom shows you what each of those 22 crops are. But as you can see, we're expecting 317.4 million acres to be planted this season to these 22 major crops. That's up just a tenth of a percent, or 214,000 acres from what was actually planted to these same crops last season. You can see the top five states listed both at the bottom and in the pie chart to the right. Just to put a little bit more perspective around that, this next chart shows that same 317.4 million acre planted estimate, but a little bit more history to track back to there. Of course, we already talked about the fact that it's very similar to last year. You can also see on this graphic, pretty comparable to what we saw before the big dip back in 2019. Of course, we all know that was largely driven by prevent plant issues that season. About 2 million acres below where we were back in 2018. The next slide that I have for you puts a little bit more perspective around that comparison back to those earlier years. Here you see an extra line on the graphic as the lighter colored line you see that says planted adjusted. Back in, beginning with that 2019 crop year, we made some program adjustments here at NASS. And so if you put everything on the same playing field here, you can see that's what that orange line represents. So with the same program definition, back in 2018, for example, it would have actually been 318.3 million acres. So about a million of those acre difference you see is simply programmatic. And so very much in line with what we've seen in recent years is the point there.
But USDA expecting tight wheat stocks.
You can see as of March the 1st, 1.02 billion bushels stored. That's down 21.8% from what was stored at the same time a year earlier. The on-farm stocks down 38.6%, off-farm down 17.2% year over year. In fact, looking at March 1 stocks historically, that would be the lowest March 1 level since 2008.
Oh, and 2008 was the last time we saw $13 wheat. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I personally believe President Putin of Russia wants to conquer all of Ukraine, but he might not be able to do so.
Dr. William Liefert is a private consultant and is retired from the Economic Research Service.
If you begin with Ukrainian territory, just in the north, down to Kyiv, and then move along Ukraine with the border with Russia, move to the east, drop down to the south, move along the Sea of Azov, and then beyond the Crimea, all the way to Mykolaiv, with this ring of territory, Russia has basically conquered this ring of territory along basically Ukraine's eastern border. I think that Putin's short-run objectives are first to take Kyiv and install a puppet government, and then to control all of the Black Sea coast. And Russia is currently blockading by sea the Ukrainian ports it doesn't control. I think that's the objective. Kyiv and the Black Sea coast in the short run.
So what does he believe the future prospects for Ukraine are?
Now, the question of how much the current troubles or how the current troubles will affect Ukraine's new crop season beginning this spring is even more difficult to answer. Depends on what happens concerning the war. There are three general scenarios. The first is that Ukraine maintains control over all or most of its territory, probably as a result of a negotiated peace. The second is that Russia conquers all or most of Ukraine. And the third is that both Ukraine and Russia control a sizable part of the country. Even if there's no continued fighting or insurgency to disrupt production, the Ukrainian grain economy will suffer from major harm to, and some degree disruption of, the country's physical and commercial infrastructure for grain and agriculture. Obtaining inputs, especially seeds, which are important for the Ukrainian grain economy, obtaining seeds could be particularly difficult for farms, though at least a lot of these inputs could be imported from Europe to the West by rail rather than by ship through the Black Sea. Ukraine's grain and overall agricultural economy will also be affected by the price shocks the invasion has generated. Though again, at least in the short run, war and policy will probably govern matters more than prices and economic incentives. The invasion has resulted in a surge in world grain prices, which increases incentives to produce and export if one can. Since the invasion, world wheat prices, they're fluctuating a bit, but they've risen by about a third. Corn prices have risen by about a quarter. Also, since all the trouble began, Ukraine's currency, the hryvnia, has depreciated against the dollar by about 12%. It's also depreciated against other currencies, which enhances the export price competitiveness of Ukrainian grain. On the other hand, agricultural input prices are also rising. World oil prices are very volatile now. They quickly spiked after the invasion. then they fell substantially. Now they're rising again, and they'll probably be higher during the year by a non-trivial amount than before the attack. Fertilizer prices are also increasing. And the depreciating hryvnia further raises the prices of imported inputs to grain producers, making depreciation a mixed blessing for agriculture. Ukraine grows virtually only winter wheat, so at least that was already planted last autumn. Its barley is about half winter and half spring. Corn and sunflower seed are both exclusively spring crops, and that planting will begin in April, May, depending on the weather. A preliminary assessment by the Food and Agriculture Organization is that because of all the difficulties, 20 to 30% of area for Ukrainian winter wheat, corn, and sunflower seed for the 2022-23 season will either go unplanted or unharvested, and that yields will also be negatively affected. USDA will let its thought be known on both the Ukrainian and Russian crop sectors for the coming year in its May WASD release.
He spoke at a recent Farm Foundation forum. Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We look back the last time we saw a run of prices like this. It was in March of 2008, and we had tight global supplies of wheat. And that July contract for Kansas City wheat went over $13 a bushel.
Dr. Mark Welch, Texas AgriLife Extension grain economist, on the fundamentals of $13 wheat.
We have seen in the last couple of weeks that price run above $12 a bushel again on the July Kansas City contract. And given the current concerns around wheat supplies, yeah, it kind of makes fundamental sense in that if you put at threat the amount of wheat that normally comes out of the Black Sea region that Ukraine and Russia supply to the global wheat trade, if that's at risk and you take that off the table, we're looking at wheat supplies as tight as they were in 2008. And so, yeah, price-wise, if you're going to set a number, kind of a target of where we might go back to, given those kind of shortages, that kind of makes sense that we would run up to that level. Now, as things are unfolding, it does look like there is some wheat that is still finding its way into the global trade, even from that area. We have several producers this year that have re-entered the global wheat export market. India is not a big wheat exporter year to year, but they've had four or five record crops in a row. So they're able to meet, especially some of that demand. If you think about geographically, India located near the Middle East and those northern African countries. So in that area where they have favorable trade relations, they can supply a lot of that grain in areas that would normally supply out of the Black Sea. It just makes sense for them to be able to meet some of those market needs. So there is some compensating factors going on. I don't think the production out of the Black Sea, even for 2022, is going to be a complete loss. It's going to be tight. High prices are going to cause a stress for particularly global wheat importers. Those countries that do rely on wheat imports in terms of questions of being able to afford it, global food security becomes a real concern. Here in the U.S., yeah, our consumers are going to see the impact of higher commodity prices, even though supplies aren't a concern. We've got plenty of wheat, but whoever uses that grain for whatever product, it's going to be a higher cost component of whatever they do with it, and that will be passed on to the consumer in many cases. So we'll all feel the impact. It's not a supply question necessarily. It's just that the price impact is going to cause some real stress for some consumers.
Could the same scenario exist for corn?
Corn is kind of a little different impact in that Ukraine particularly is a much more significant supplier of global corn exports than they are wheat. They're a major wheat exporter, but they participate more so in the corn market. And then when it comes to corn, we have fewer market participants to make up the slack if Ukraine is short. Brazil's coming back strong this year if things play out. Of course, the U.S., we'll see what our acreage numbers look like with all the competition among other crops for what our planning decisions will be. But when it comes to corn, if we were to lose a significant amount of export potential from Ukraine in 2022, that's really a bigger impact than even in the wheat market. And we haven't seen the corn price run to record levels like we've seen in corn. In the wheat market. So that may yet be ahead of us if we do see the conflict continue to play out and depending on what reports like the Prospective Planners Report show us for corn acres in 2022.
But do you recall the discussion on whether it was the new normal?
I think we do need to put that in perspective, and that gives us a good context that when we do these situations like in 2008 or 2012, these high prices provide the incentive for producers not only in the U.S. but all over the world to increase production. Now, given the input challenges, whether it's the price of fertilizer or the availability of herbicides and pesticides here for 2022, there may be some real challenges of doing that this year. But over time, You bet. Not only the American farmer, but global farmers have shown their resiliency and their perseverance. And if you give them a price, they'll produce to it. And it's, I expect that to certainly to continue, even out of all the turmoil that we're seeing in this current market, that given time, we will respond on a productive side of that to meet this challenge.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
At the Federal Reserve, we are strongly committed to achieving maximum employment and price stability.
The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, announcing the other day the first of what could be a series of interest rate hikes. In the past, there have been some studies showing that when interest rates go up, it puts downward pressure on retail food prices.
And we will have to keep a very close eye on what actually happens this time around.
USDA economist Matt McLaughlin, here's the theory behind the idea that higher interest rates might help slow down food price inflation.
When the Fed increases interest rates, this typically makes the cost of borrowing money higher and the overall money supply shrinks. This means the availability of cash or the demand side pressures come down. And that's typically across the board.
But he says it seems to work more for big ticket or luxury items, but food demand is not very elastic. So Matt says we'll just have to wait and see what happens as these new interest rates kick in. Gary Crawford, Washington.